This is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Tony Cohn. Just a heads up to our listeners that the following episode has some graphic accounts of violence. From the outside of the house, everything looks normal. It's modest but tidy, like the houses that you've seen in so many American neighborhoods. There's a porch with two chairs, and a door ushers visitors into the kitchen. These people aren't wealthy, but their house feels inviting. It's comfortable. Beyond the kitchen door, there's a table half set for breakfast. Two dining room chairs and a high chair stand at attention. It's a cozy room, one that hints at happiness for a small but growing family. But then, you notice a gun on the floor. The first hint that all is not well. Near the gun, a crimson bloodstain shatters any illusion of domestic bliss. Standing inside the kitchen, you see that the bedroom door is cracked open. Light spills across the tan carpet and onto a mess of rumpled blankets. Suddenly, you notice the body and your heart drops. A woman lies in bed facing the wall. Blood has soaked into the bedsheets around her. But the gore doesn't end there. You peer into the bedroom and notice a second pair of feet. A man is on the floor, bloody and dead. He's lying on a blanket in his pajamas.
You find that this is a multiple homicide, that the wife of this family is dead in her bed.
This is Nora Atkinson.
The husband is on the side of the bed. The baby has been killed in the crib, and there's mayhem strewn around the household.
All told, three bodies. Husband, wife, baby. All dead by gunshot.
And it does look like this very well-to-do family, and you wonder what happened here. Was there an intruder that came in through one of the windows? Did he kill the husband? You can't quite tell what happened here.
Nora Atkinson isn't an investigator or even the police. She's actually a curator of the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery, a museum dedicated to contemporary American crafts in Washington, D.C. And that horrific crime scene she describes is about the size of a child's wagon. And the dead family, they're not really dead. In fact, they were never alive to begin with. Because, well, they're porcelain dolls.
They're dollhouses with little murdered corpses in them.
Yeah, you heard that right. Dollhouses with little corpses. Kind of a Barbie and Ken murder mystery, but with a purpose. Each year, police investigators try to solve this murder. So who committed this crime? Why would someone want to depict this grisly dollhouse murder, and why are these dollhouses on display at the Smithsonian's Craft Museum? The solution begins with a woman named Frances Glessner Lee. We'll meet her and get to the bottom of these mini murders right after a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
In the late 1800s, society had very specific ideas of how young women should spend their time, especially if they came from wealthy families. They typically weren't expected to have a career or even maintain interests outside of the house. But, as Nora Atkinson can attest, Frances Glessner Lee was not your typical 19th century woman.
So she was this very precocious young lady who was born into the Glessner family. She was the heiress to the International Harvester fortune in Chicago.
I sat down with Nora before the museum opened in her office to learn just how odd Frances really was. Born in 1878, Frances Glessner was an heiress who also happened to have a big thing for detective novels.
If you think about that time period, it was right in the mid-1890s that the first Sherlock Holmes came out.
What have you found, Holmes? Footprints?
Yes. A club-footed man, about 5'11", I should say.
You think these are the footprints of a murderer?
It's possible. Yes. Yes, it's quite possible.
Though Sherlock Holmes' science of deduction was popular, there was something else sensational and terrifying happening at the same time. When Francis was 15 years old, a very different Holmes, H.H. Holmes, America's first serial killer, was creeping around Chicago where the Glessners lived, picking off his victims one by one. And his favorite targets? Young women.
So I imagine that Francis must have been gripped by these cases, as everybody in the country was.
Francis, or Fanny, as her family called her, was smart and very curious, which today most parents would probably think, great, but reading books and medical texts was not seen as an interest becoming of a wealthy young lady in 1890.
Her parents didn't particularly appreciate that. When she was in her maybe teens, her brother went off to Harvard University and she stayed behind.
For a teenager hungry for knowledge, it's easy to imagine this might have been a bitter pill for young Fanny. Her brother goes to study at one of the best schools in the world, and she just stays at home, reading textbooks on the sly and learning what she can on her own.
And as young ladies did, she made her society debut and married a young man named Blewett Lee.
Reading through the history, it's hard to see this as anything besides a blah marriage. Frances and her husband Blewett Lee had different goals and passions.
She got bored. She and Blewett Lee ended up divorcing.
But in divorce, Fanny found some degree of freedom. She moved 1,000 miles away from Chicago to her family's vast New Hampshire estate. There, Fanny could read all of the medical texts and all of the Sherlock Holmes that she wanted.
You've a magnificent brain, Moriarty. I admire it. I admire it so much I'd like to present it pickled in alcohol to the London Medical Society.
That would make an interesting exhibit.
Fanny's brother had a friend at Harvard who she knew from his visits to the family estate in New Hampshire. His name was George McGrath. They were close friends who had a lot of mutual interests. And we really don't know much more about it than that. Sadly, gossip columnists in the late 1920s didn't write enough about Gilded Age heiresses and their medical examiner friends. But here's what we do know. McGrath visited the Glessner family home with some frequency, and we do know that they shared some similar interests. From 1907 to 1935, he was Boston's medical examiner, and he saw some things. Murders, corpses, all kinds of crime scenes. And he was pretty cavalier in what he shared with Francis. We know George McGrath never married, and while his obituary in the New York Times doesn't mention Frances by name, like any other crime scene, a properly trained eye can see her fingerprints all over it. She donated a chunk of money in 1931 to endow the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard Med School.
It was the first one on the continent to be formed in that sort of burgeoning years of the forensics field.
Its first hire? None other than George McGrath himself. Frances also created the George Burgess McGrath Library in his name. And this time, she gave more than just money.
She donated a library of about 3,000 books to Harvard, all on this subject. So she'd been studying this her whole life, but it had been this kind of private obsession of hers.
So we'll never really know if there was more to their relationship, but it is safe to say that Francis and George McGrath were very close friends, and that she was very interested in his work. A few years later, in 1936, Fanny's father died. And as John Glessner's sole remaining heir, she inherited the bulk of his fortune.
She came into her own, she came into her fortune, and she could do what she pleased.
And what Francis pleased was to work with police and study crime scenes. More on that after a quick break.
Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.
Let's run down Francis Glessner Lee's rap sheet. In 1878, she was born into money, but with wealth came a lot of expectations. While her brother went off to Harvard, Frances, a young woman of society, wasn't allowed to get an education. Instead, she got married, had kids, and then she got divorced. All the while, Frances had been reading medical literature, hearing the ins and outs of police investigation techniques from her medical examiner friend, and, of course, devouring detective novels. Then, when her father died, Frances inherited the family's fortune. At this point in our story, Frances is rolling in the cash, but is feeling a little conflicted about it. Frances wrote about it in her own words.
I didn't do a lick of work to deserve what I have. Therefore, I feel I have been left an obligation to do something that will benefit everybody.
So Frances had an interesting idea. She put together all of her varied police investigation knowledge to create crime scenes. And I don't mean that she went on a killing spree. Frances very meticulously created miniature murder scenes, similar to the grim triple homicide that we described at the beginning of this story. The dioramas are complete with dead bodies, fake bloodstains, and tiny clues that, if read correctly, reveal the secret of how each doll died. She called them the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death.
They're called nutshells because there was an old police saying to convict the guilty, clear the innocent, and find the truth in a nutshell.
That's Nora Atkinson again, the Smithsonian craft curator.
So she grabbed onto that, and it seems like the perfect description.
19 of the dollhouse murder scenes survive today, and they are as varied as they are morbid. There's one that shows a farmer hanging from a rafter in a barn. Another has a woman lying face down on the stairs. And a third has a victim lying half in a bathtub, legs sticking up in the air. What they have in common, though, is their incredible attention to detail.
So she would go to the extent that there are tiny little cigarettes in one of them in the living room. And these cigarettes at 1 inch to 1 foot scale, so at, you know, maybe a third of an inch, have been rolled by hand with real nicotine inside of them.
We're not just talking about miniature cigarettes here. Frances would go so far as to recreate the exact covers of newspapers from the time. In each of the Nutshell Studies, all of the windows actually open and the lights really work. The doors even have little tiny locks that turn with even tinier keys. In one diorama, there's a miniature sewing machine with, yes, a doll-sized threaded needle. Leave it to Frances to find a way to thread a needle that small.
She was a real stickler for making sure that every detail was correct because she realized that in order for these to be taken seriously, an investigator really had to be able to immerse himself in it and believe that he was 6 inches tall.
Because remember, Frances wasn't making these miniature crime scenes for fun. Through her research and her relationship with George McGrath, Frances knew what made compelling evidence and how good police might approach a crime scene. So she made these dioramas as a teaching tool to run detective training seminars. Frances Glessner Lee wanted to turn police detective work into a science.
She came up with this ingenious idea to create a series of dioramas that she could fit in the back of her car and bring around to go teach these seminars. And they would assign these cases to investigators to really immerse themselves into a real three-dimensional environment where they had to discover the clues and work through the cases and talk about them in the training seminars.
Okay, we gotta pause to appreciate Frances Glessner Lee for a second. In the 1930s and 40s, women were not police. Largely, they were expected to stay at home. But here we have a self-taught woman holding seminars and teaching police how to do their job, kind of like a female Sherlock Holmes.
And what would you propose that I should do, Mr. Holmes?
Find the murderer.
What? If that man didn't club Lloyd Brandon to death, who did?
Nobody. Brandon was strangled to death.
Strangled?
Yes. The wounds on the back of his head were administered post-mortem.
Are you sure of that, Miss Rose?
Absolutely. Talk to the medical examiner if you have any doubts.
Welcome to the office of the chief medical examiner. I recently took the train up to Baltimore to visit the mini crime scenes in the office of Baltimore's medical examiner, where they're normally kept. Name, Tony Cohn. Company, Smithsonian. Oh, Ariel just beat us. Ariel O'Connor is an objects conservator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
And right now, I am here to study and clean and conserve these nutshell studies and prepare them to safely transit to the Renwick Gallery.
When Ariel and I spoke, Francis's nutshells were weeks away from being moved to Washington, D.C. to be displayed at the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery. It's Ariel's job to make sure art and other artifacts don't deteriorate while they're in the Smithsonian's care. Or, in the case of the nutshells, restore them to their original condition as if they were just finished by Frances Glessner Lee herself.
So this is the experience a viewer at the Renwick or when someone comes here to the Baltimore Medical Examiner's office, this is the view they would have,
yes,
correct?
That's correct.
Would you describe what that view is, like what we're looking at, kind of set the scene for us?
Sure. So what we're looking at is one of the nutshell studies of unexplained death, and there are 19 nutshells that survive. Originally, there were 20. One was destroyed, so we have 19 left, and this is one that's called Living Room. And so when you approach the nutshell, you're looking in as if one of the walls on the side of this living room is missing, so you're peering into this domestic scene. And then as you look to the back on the stairs, then you see a body. And as you look around the scene, you start to look for clues to try to uncover what may have happened to her.
I don't even know where I would start for clues. So I notice immediately that it looks as though someone was sitting on the armchair and was pushed off. I'm looking at the cushion where someone would sit, and you can see, that the padding is off. Like someone was just sitting there but was pushed away, and there's newspapers on the ground. Perhaps they were reading them, and when they were forced off the chair, the newspapers fell at their side. The cigarettes may be another on the table next to them would be another clue that they'd been sitting there for a while.
What do you notice in the fireplace?
There's wood, but it isn't lit. There's something underneath the wood in the fireplace. I know that Francis is like out to get me. I know there's a lot of stuff here. I don't know. Do you have any theories? I don't know if you know the answers or if you can share.
So I actually don't know the solutions to these. And that's been a very interesting challenge as a conservator, because the placement of every tiny item in here could be a clue. And I don't know whether it is or isn't. So every item that I suspect may have moved over time or have shifted, I can ask Bruce, is this a clue? Is this location?
Oh, Bruce Goldfarb is the keeper of the nutshells. We're going to meet him momentarily.
And if it's not, then I can start to look for evidence on the object itself for a glue residue and try to determine whether it is in its original location where she put it, or perhaps it's aged or moved over time.
It's very important that Ariel keeps things in their original location, because if she doesn't, it could change the meaning of the scenes for the police who are learning to gather evidence. But to really understand the nutshells, there's one guy that you gotta meet.
My name is Bruce Goldfarb, and I'm the executive assistant to the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland.
Bruce is a bit of a nutshell nut. He appreciates how intricate and artistic they are.
They are extraordinary craft and art, but I think that she'd be quite surprised that they are appreciated as a collection of art. I don't think that she intended to create art. It was sort of incidental. What she wanted to do was to teach police officers.
Though the nutshells are going to be displayed in an art gallery, Bruce's perspective on them is informed by their original purpose, as Frances Glessner Lee had intended them to be used. A tool to make police detectives better.
Before Frances, there was no training for homicide detectives. A lot of these guys, if you look at the time period, before the 1930s, police departments weren't necessarily professionals. I mean, they literally had, no training. You didn't have to be particularly smart. It was important that you be strong, brave, that you could go into a bar and break up a fight, that you could intimidate a witness, force a confession. Things were a little different back then.
Frances once explained her philosophy of crime scene detection in this way.
It is an unremitting quest for facts. It is a constant and continuous search for truth in the interests of science and justice, to expose the guilty, to clear the innocent. It is a dedication of its own peculiar wisdom and experience to the service of mankind.
Frances and her ethos helped to revolutionize police training in the 1930s and 40s. But the amazing thing is that Frances's nutshells are still being used today, 80 years after they were first created. Detectives in training continue to come to Baltimore to work in person with Francis's dioramas and to learn the methods of crime scene investigation.
It's a week-long seminar, 5 days, very intensive, where, you know, it's all-day lectures. It's regarded, you know, as it still is one of the best of its kind that exists.
The seminar itself runs once or twice a year.
And it's still today run very much as it was in 1945.
Each group of 4 to 6 people is assigned a nutshell, and they work together to come up with a solution.
And then on the last day, they have to give up, stand up and present their observations.
And at the end, do they get the answer? Like, do they know that it was Colonel Mustard with the rope in the library?
Well, part of it is that the nutshells really aren't meant to be solved. They're really not whodunits. The solution is not to figure out who did what. You don't have complete information. You don't have an autopsy report. You don't have the ability to ask questions and, you know, witnesses and these sorts of things. So you're only working with partial information. Any kind of answer of who did it is really, it's not the destination, it's the path of getting there.
I find it kind of hard to imagine a room full of tough police officers taking Little Dollhouse murder scene seriously. But the fact that they do speaks to Francis's vision for the evolution of police work.
She really is, you know, the mother of forensic science and revolutionized the field. Everything that we know today of in a CSI sort of investigation that comes from Frances Glessner-Lee and the Harvard program that she founded.
For her commitment to advancing the science of detective work, the New Hampshire State Police made her an honorary captain in 1943, the first woman in the country to have that title. And she was the first woman to join the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Toward the end of her life, Frances's eyesight began to fail her. Given her reputation as a tireless worker, her doctors tried to force her to rest as much as possible. But Frances's love of crime solving persisted. She had a police radio installed in her bedroom so she could listen to the sounds of police working as she fell asleep. Frances died in 1962 at the age of 83. Standing here in 2017, it's kind of hard to imagine just how shocking the figure of Francis Glessner-Lee must have been to all of the Harvard academics and the tough farm-raised police around her. This was a woman without a college degree. She got divorced at a time when people stayed in unhappy marriages. They just didn't do that. If you asked an average beat cop in 1940 if women belonged in the police force, it would be hard to imagine a very progressive response. And yet, Frances Glessner-Lee was the driving force in creating the field of forensic science, not to mention that she radically changed how police do their job. And in her police technique, her perspective as a woman was a feature, not a bug. She saw things differently than a lot of the male detectives who had preconceived ideas about the people that they were finding dead. But that's not to say it was easy for Frances. All of her work is featured at the Renwick in a new exhibit called Murder is Her Hobby. And there's a telling reason why.
Actually, I stole that title from an article from Popular Mechanics that was done in, I think it was the 1950s or early 60s, that was about Frances Glessner-Lee. And it says this 77-year-old dowager has this hobby creating miniatures and has become a major investigator and criminologist. And I found that to be the perfect encapsulation of Frances's life, because she was very well respected in her field. The people that she worked with adored her. But at the same time, no one really knew where to place her. And I think that it's a little bit condescending in its own way. Murder is her hobby.
Frances Glessner-Lee defied categorization. On one hand, she was a grandmother, an heiress, and a divorcee. But on the other, she was a pioneer, a self-taught criminologist, and an honorary police captain. One of my favorite details in all of the 19 nutshells is this tiny copy of the Sherlock Holmes story, The Sign of Four. It reminds me of where this whole thing started, with Frances as a teenager, reading detective novels and bunking conventions. Who could have guessed how far Frances's curiosity would have ended up taking her? Okay, maybe someone could have guessed.
Elementary, my dear Watson. Purely elementary.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you want to investigate the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Deaths in person, they're on exhibit at the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery here in Washington, D.C. until January 28th, 2018. For more information on how to do that or see some images of the Nutshells, check them out on our website, si.edu/sidedoor. And if you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice little review. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Rachel Aronoff, Stacia Brown, Jason Orfanin, Gabe Kozowitz, Jess Sadek, and Elizabeth Pilger. Extra support comes from John Barth and Barbara Rehm. I'm your host, Tony Cohn. Thanks for listening.